From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in two schools, one in a suburb, one in the city of Rochester. Which school would you expect to have better amenities? Which school would have better athletic facilities or expansive music equipment or a strong art program? Just more modernized classrooms. Chances are you assume the suburban district would have more than the city, but is that true? And if it is that about to change? The facilities modernization program has been occasionally controversial over the years, but it is designed to bring Rochester in line with all schools. And new construction is coming. It's the first conversation on this program focusing on the plans behind it. So we're going to try to answer a lot of questions. Our partners at the Democrat and Chronicle have done such good work reporting on questions and issues that have come up over the years on this. We just want to be updated as to what the program is now and what is coming next. And let me say hello to our guests in studio. Alan Williams is the chair of the Rochester Joint Schools Construction Board. Alan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Mike Schmidt. Mike is vice chair of the Rochester Joint Schools Construction Board. Mike, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
And Travis Miller is business opportunities program manager for Savin Engineers. Travis, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back to the beginning. And Alan and Mike, for our listeners who are, you know, maybe they hear the term or, you know, schools and facilities modernization, but aren't really familiar with just how long this has been going on and what the plan has been. It goes back about a decade. Why don't you just give a little history first, and then we'll talk about what's coming.
Okay. Overall, Evan, it's a, when completed, it'll be about a $1.2 billion program, and it's divided, or will be divided, in anywhere from 3 to 4 stages. Right now, we're in stage, or phase two. We've completed phase one. And which included schools like Schools 58, School 12, School 50.
Mike's handing over a list because there's a lot I know.
Charlotte High School, Franklin, as well as East and Edison were in the first phase, phase one, and they'll be continuing into phase two. In addition to that, there is something else called the District-Wide Technology Program, and in that piece, all of the, for the most part, the electronic and internet infrastructure within the district will be upgraded.
What's the timeline right now, Alan?
In terms of,
Is there going to be a day in the future that's not unforeseeable where this is going to be done?
Well, overall, it looks like about 2021 for the entire $1.2 billion. Phase of it. The first phase was $325 million, phase one. Second phase, which we're going through now, will be $435 million. So we'll have another $600 to $700 million to go in phases three and or four.
Okay. And Mike, what are the hurdles right now to getting there? I mean, we're going to get into some specific questions that some in our community have had and raised, especially in the last year. But what would you say the hurdles are in front of this program right now?
I think for us, just being certain that our planning aligns with the infrastructure and the instructional needs going forward, we want to make sure that the classrooms that we are redesigning line up with the instructional model that will be ahead of us. And I think the most important piece is to kind of really envision what classrooms of the future will actually be like and have enough flexibility in our program to be able to modify things in short term but also long term. From the day-to-day operational piece, it's just about, I would think, more logistically moving schools and students into and out of swing spaces as we renovate those schools in a reasonable amount of time, a 1 or 2 year period. And we've been able to do that with limited inconvenience, but there's always challenges with that.
Okay. And Travis Miller from Savin Engineers, tell us what your role and the company's role is in going forward with this.
The Rochester Joint School Construction Board targeted using the resources of this program to not just be about bricks and mortar, but also to provide a platform for business development of minority, women, small, and disadvantaged business enterprises. So Savin Engineers is a minority business enterprise that has been involved in public K-12 construction for over 30 years. And we are retained to serve as the program manager to act in behalf of the board to oversee all of the various pieces of the program. But in addition, the business opportunities program, which I manage, has been put in place to provide training, mentoring, and also community outreach so that the various facets and resources of the program can be communicated to everyone in the area.
Okay, now listeners, if you have any questions or comments on Rochester Schools Modernization, the facilities program that we're talking about today, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I have not myself done a lot of sort of in the weeds reporting on this, and that's why I mentioned off the top, you know, our colleagues both here at WXXI, but really the Democrat and Chronicle has done a lot on this. Megan McDermott, Justin Murphy, a number of others there. And what I want to ask our guests is what has perhaps changed to address some of the issues that were raised back in January. Now, back in January, Justin Murphy's piece, the Rochester City School District may lack space for pre-K growth. But again, we're going back to January here. So what I want to do is raise some of the issues that came up then, and we'll talk about how maybe things have been addressed and changed. Number one, Justin wrote that several factors have emerged over time as this facility's modernization has been happening, and he writes, quote, some of them outside the district's control, including an influx of refugee students and children needing special education services. And the district has also made a priority of full-day kindergarten, pre-kindergarten for 4- and 3-year-olds. So let me ask, you know, I'll start with you, Alan. Justin's raising the point there that, you know, when you've got a modernization program, some of the dynamics change. And in this case, you get more refugee students, you have more special needs students. Has that been taken into account? Is that being addressed? And is there the capacity for that?
Right. And keep in mind that the whole process is pretty dynamic in the sense that, you know, 10 years ago is when they put out the master plan.
Right.
Phase one was completed. In the process of being completed, you know, as we speak in terms of the overall closeout. And phase two has started. But with that, with the updates, in terms of the influx of, or the, well, the influx of refugee students, as well as Rochester was one of the, I think, the few cities within New York State that got the approval or the funding to expand the 3-year-old program. Those will now be taken into account for phases 2, 3, and possibly 4.
Okay, and is there space and capacity for pre-K in particular?
For pre-K, yes. But what we have to do is within each time we do a master plan or an update, we take into account the overall or projected student population, and that will be factored into the plans as we go forward.
Okay, and coupled with some of what Justin was writing about in that piece were some comments made by Board President Van White. And again, we're going back to January here, but I'm curious to know what has been addressed since then. So what Van White said at the time was, quote, it appeared to us the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. In other words, the expensive building renovations did not necessarily take into account the needs of the students who would study there. And White said it became pretty evident that the facilities plan happened in a facility silo that wasn't connected to the instructional people. We need to make sure those people are all in alignment. Alan, was that fair at the time, and has that been addressed? Do you think that was an unfair comment?
I think it's unfair because one of the things that has happened as we go through and we look at each individual school, we make it a point to talk to all of the stakeholders involved, particularly the district, as well as parents, also state ed, in terms of, you know, one of the things we have to do, and we start to talk about special ed students, we have to get the okay from state ed that we've taken into account any projected numbers for special ed students. I mean, each particular school has to have a certain number of classroom space set aside for special ed students.
Okay.
And in addition to that, we, you know, when you look at schools that have a heavy population of either refugee students or students where English is a second language, that those factors also are taken into account as we go through and renovate the individual buildings.
All right, but those are specific issues, but reading that article, the wider view from a reader might be, well, you've got a school's modernization program, and the people who are charged with choosing the construction and doing some of the hard brick mm-hmm. and mortar work aren't necessarily regularly hooked up with the people who are doing the instructional work, whether it's pre-K, whether it's handling an influx of refugee students or anything, and that there needs to be more of a merging so whatever is being carried out brick and mortar does match the needs. So broadly speaking, tell me how that's happening.
Well, one of the things that happened, say we're looking at school number 10, okay? So in each and every case, we'll start with the facilities department at the district, which Mike is in charge of overall. In addition to that, we'll sit down and have meetings with both the superintendent as well as the principals. And we have meetings with what's called the BAC, the Building Advisory Council, which is made up of both students and parents, to make sure that we take into account all of the issues or concerns that they may have. Now, one of the things that you want to bear in mind, especially when the article came out, was that, you know, 10 years ago, the master plan was set out. And then when phase one was completed, phase two was about to start, about 2 years ago is when we received the additional funding for three-year-old EPK students. Mm-hmm. So since then, we've had to or will take into account how will those students be accommodated within the schools.
Okay, so Mike, you agree with Alan there that some of that criticism that the right hand didn't know what the left was doing was unfair?
I think in the environment that we're working with, it's very fluid. And as Alan said, I think the items that the article pointed out were accurate. The dynamics have changed just in my short time here in the district over the last 5 years. With the influx of pre-K education and the types of spaces that those students need in order to be successful are very different than what a fifth grade student would need or what a high school student would need. So as we're planning going forward, we are incorporating those into our elementary schools. So every elementary school will have dedicated pre-K, three-year-old, pre-K, four-year-old spaces because those are very specified locations. And then it'll all tie in instructionally with a pre-K 6 or pre-K 8 continuum. I think the other part of it is our needs of our special education students, and those are also very unique. We currently have students that are being serviced not only in district but also across the county, so we're trying to incorporate those specific needs of those students, what those instructional spaces look like, and that's also a very fluid conversation. So I wouldn't go as far as to constitute that one hand not knowing what the other would be doing, but I do think that there is, because the dynamics continually are being adjusted, it is a very much a moving target. One thing that in response to that, what we've done here in the district is begin in much more dynamic pre-planning for what we envision to be phase three. The Path Forward initiative, which is taken on by our senior team and our superintendent, is lining very much at the front end our instructional vision with the facilities that we'll be focusing on in phase three. So we've learned lessons in phase one. We've learned lessons in phase two, which I think the article really pointed out. Our phase two initiative is, I think, much more tight in terms of an instructional alignment and our facility piece than phase one. And subsequently, our phase three will be, I think, even more directly aligned. But I think having those conversations now on the front end, which we're doing across our community, will only enhance the product in phase three. I think the other thing that I would point out in our elementary schools in this phase, because we were able to take on a second maximum cost allowance from the state, which they were, they understood our situation. We were able to, in a sense, fully do complete gut renovations of those 8 elementary schools, bring all those pre-K classes inside the building. Currently, they're in some transportable classrooms, and align those 8 buildings completely instructionally with what our instructional vision is in terms of it. I think the other part that we've been able to do is repurpose spaces into more collaborative or maker spaces that will really change the instructional program at an elementary or at a high school piece. So I think we're really positioning very well for a very successful phase two, and I think more successful phases going forward.
Go ahead, Alan.
A couple other things, too, Alan, I'd like to point out is that we have monthly meetings scheduled between the program manager, seven engineers, and the superintendent and or the superintendent staff to really look at what's going on with the individual projects and address any kind of issues that may arise. In addition to that, whenever we go out and we start a major phase of the construction, Savin Engineer or the BOP program, which Travis is in charge of, they go out and they make sure that they survey or reach out to the community to have them come in and take into account any kind of concerns that they may have, both with the start of the construction as well as the construction progresses.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go next, because in observing how other journalists have covered these issues over recent years, one of the common I think in any case where there's change, some parents and people in a community, change can be hard or change can be resisted in some ways. But one of the complaints that I've heard with some regularity is that communication, especially with parents, could be better. So what you're describing is one way to do that. Travis, you want to add to that too, the importance of making sure parents and stakeholders understand what's coming?
Absolutely. One of the first endeavors that we had to do was to design a new website that we really want to be the primary focal point for the communities to be able to find out what the latest was in relation to the program, scope of work, and schedule. But in particular to each school, what we endeavor to do is through building advisory committees that are made up of stakeholders both within the school itself and neighborhood associations that are in the vicinities of these schools to allow them to be aware of the design process as it evolves. And then when we reach the point for construction to be mobilized, that we, even if it's by door-to-door distribution of flyers, let the residents know about what the project will entail, its length, if there are any issues, who they should contact. These are all things that we're managing.
What's a common complaint from parents? Is it that they don't want their kid to be in a mobile classroom for a little while, or do they have sort of an emotional tie to certain buildings, or do they just not know what's going on?
Well, there are different dynamics for each school. Certainly the state education department for a few years now has really been pushing to eliminate temporary classrooms that are in trailers and mobile facilities like that. And so that represents a big part, especially with many of the elementary schools that are in this phase, that those are being eliminated. But likewise, because Rochester students right now are so dispersed throughout various quadrants of the city, there has been a lot of dialogue in relation to trying to create a little bit more of the neighborhood school approach. And to that extent, a good example is what's happening at School 16, where the residents in the 19th Ward have been very proactive in trying to work with the school district to express their hopes that with the reorganization of that school, it will provide an opportunity for more students in the local vicinity to be able to attend.
Mike, are you satisfied with the level of communication with parents on this?
I certainly think we can always improve on it. I think we continue to reach out consistently through not only our school chiefs but our principals to those the stakeholders in those individual school communities. But there's always more you can do. I think we've what Travis said in regards to the website upgrades. Our own district website has now just recently been rolled out and realigned with specific links to a variety of the not only the Path Forward work but also to the modernization program work. We are doing much more outreach in terms of parent communication in areas where they are more likely to meet. So for traditionally, it's always we've looked at having parents come to a school, an open house type of an event, and that certainly works for some parents. But there's an awful lot of parents that model doesn't work for. So we need to continue to adjust how we move forward, and whether it's working with the faith community or whether it's working with recreation centers or whatever it might be, wherever our community and our parents are meeting and having conversations, even if it's at kitchen tables, then that's where we need to go and have those dialogues. And that those adjustments have been very successful. So I do think the critique is not based. I think there is some areas where we needed to grow, but I also think in this phase we've been much more successful with it.
All right, listeners, again, I'm going to read a couple of your emails and questions that have come in already, but I also will invite you to call the program if you want. If you've got questions about school construction in Rochester and the facilities modernization program, this is your chance to understand exactly what's coming. If you want to know how those decisions were made and what the schedule might be, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This is a massive undertaking, many years in the making, and it's a good chance for you to better understand how changes are coming and continue to be coming to Rochester school facilities. You just heard Mike Schmidt. He's the vice chair of the Rochester Joint Schools Construction Board. Alan Williams is the chair, and Travis Miller is Business Opportunities Program Manager for Savin Engineers. Alan writes to the program, and you can email us, by the way, connections@WXXI.org. Alan writes to us and says, where is the money coming from to pay for all of this? And so I'm sure that's a common question. Alan, Go ahead.
It's coming from, bonds, for the most part. We just had a bond issue that we recently did for the first part of phase two. And those bonds are being, they were issued by the city on behalf of the project. And the repayment basically is coming back from the state, as we receive reimbursements from the state, something in the range of 98 cents on the dollar. In addition
from the
to
state.
From the state. In addition to that, there is also a what's called a local share, wherein whatever it is the state does reimburse, then the district, the RCSD, has to put in or make up that difference.
Okay. Alan, thanks for that question. Emily wanted to she emailed and just asked, did one of your guests mention makerspaces? Can you tell us more about that? I think that was you, Mike. Did you mention makerspaces?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So we've been able to put in place makerspaces, or I think they're...
Tell us more about what that is.
Sure. For like a better way to explain it, it's a much more of a dynamic instructional space where students can do a variety of hands-on learning activities, and those degree of activities obviously are different at an elementary versus a high school. But there's a component for robotics, there's a component for quite a bit of architectural work, there's a whole technology piece to it. Our first makerspace will be completed within the next 18 months at Edison. And we hope to have multiple spaces there. That's the whole focus of that of the Edison Technology Campus is to have more students working in those type of things. But in order to have a dynamic learning environment where students are working in that hands-on area, you have to have the facilities and the infrastructure behind that. So wherever that would be, all the necessary items where in those kind of technology spaces. So we have, I would say the. Areas where we can actually build the actual models themselves and have that type of a place, but also the actual technology to design those. So think about designing your own robot, so to speak. You would do that in four different areas and kind of lay that out. So that's the whole idea, the whole concept behind those spaces. And I think we have what our main intention is to create those dynamic spaces at the elementary and at the high school level so that as the instructional focuses shift, and we really don't know what we're going to look like in 20 years in terms of how students are interacting with their instructors or with their teachers, we want to make sure we have the capability behind the scenes. We also want to make sure that we have the ability for our students when they step out of that type of a work environment that they can go, they can step immediately into the workplace and where much more of our work is done in those type of work environments. So I think it just allows the students to have more of a hands-on approach and be able to transition into higher education or into a workplace environment much more easily.
Yeah, Mike, you said earlier this hour you want to make sure that we are building the modern classrooms. And
yes,
well, it sounds like what you're describing is schools that will have maybe sort of a hybrid of a classroom like the ones that you and I have grown up knowing and understanding, and probably most of our listeners, but also sometimes that space that makerspaces, things mm-hmm. like that allow for hands-on skills, that allow for trade skills, those kinds of things.
Sure.
But when you say a modern classroom, is that part of it, or what more are you envisioning? What do you think this program envisions for the modern classroom?
Well, I think if we envision what a dynamic workplace looks like, and you think of where our people are very successful in the professional environment, it's an area where students can move about a classroom or a school very freely and work in different settings. So whether they work in a small group at a table, or they're working in a more comfortable area of a room where there might be some more comfortable seating or a discussion area, all those type of things we built into the classroom. So one of it is the infrastructure behind the wall, so to speak, the internet access and so on and so forth. But the other piece of it is to make sure that we have position where we have whiteboards or smart boards positioned around the room so that those students can interact in smaller or larger groups, and that the teachers or the instructors in those rooms have the training, so to speak, to work with that new type of technology. So it's just kind of envisioning what works best in our most dynamic and successful companies and bringing that down to into our classroom environment and then doing it to scale.
Alan, sticking with the theme, I would think that you can't do these kinds of updating of classrooms if you're not communicating with what educators need, right?
Right, correct. And that's one of the things, especially when we start to look at things like the district-wide technology piece, for example, and talking to both the vendor who will provide the technology infrastructure, as well as we want to make sure that they are paired with both the teachers and the administrators in terms of we want to make sure that their needs are being met, and that as we start to think about how will teaching change in the foreseeable future, we want to make sure that we have the flexibility to make those kinds of changes. You know, and one of the things we're looking at too, Evan, in addition to the technology piece, we also want to make sure that we update the classrooms and provide things like music, art, science, technology, as we go forward, to make sure that all of the students in the city school district have access to those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, after our only break of the hour, which is coming up in just a moment, I'll read another listener comment that gets at this, sort of that stereotype that city schools have X and suburban schools have X, and is this going to kind of tighten that gap? Because one of our listeners has a question about that. Also want to let you know that you can follow along with the Joint Schools Construction Board's work and the school's modernization program, rsmpnews.net. So it's rsmpnews.net for the latest information, project updates. If you want to see what they are doing and if you've got questions about that, you can get those answered. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back. As I said, we'll get that question that just came in from a listener on comparing suburbs and city schools. And as we talk about the school's modernization program, if you want to weigh in with more, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Evan Dawson. You can call the program. It's toll free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're right back. Coming up in our second hour, we will bring in the clowns, literally, several clowns on a panel discussing why so many people are scared of clowns. And we will get into the science of clowns and our fear of them. There is some real science behind it. It's interesting stuff. Right now, the movie It is setting box office records with Pennywise the Dancing Clown as the villain, but it's hardly the only to portray clowns as scary, so we'll explore those fears and see if we can change them next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about the future of Rochester City Schools and the school's modernization program, which is a decade old. It's a $1.2 billion enterprise, and phase two continuing through 2021 with a total value of $435 million divided among 14 projects. And we're talking about what those are, how those decisions are made, how they're trying to modernize classrooms, the challenges, and how they're trying to execute that. If you've got questions, it's a good time to get them in. And Fred writes to the program and tells us the following. He says, Evan, I'm not like some suburban parents who used to live in the city but moved to the suburbs when our kids became of school age. I've always lived in the suburbs or in rural areas, but as our family gets older, we would love to consider moving to the city. But of course, until our kids are out of high school, most of our friends think that would be unwise. I'd like to know if your guests think that this is changing that consideration for families like mine that would like to move to the city. Schools will always be a consideration. Is this part of achieving parity with the suburbs? That's from Fred. Alan, I'll start with you.
And I would say yes. When we look at, you know, I tour a lot of the buildings that we are in the process now of renovating and bringing a lot of modern technology, teaching methods to the various schools. And I think it will, especially when I look at a place like Edison, for example. And I know in talking to the administrators over there, one of the things they're trying to do is they want to make Edison sort of the lighthouse of technical and vocational education in the entire area. And I think once the project, the renovation project at Edison is done, I think it'll go a long way to do that. And the next phase really is challenging or changing the perception of a lot of people in the suburbs and in the city in terms of what they can expect if they send their children to a city school. I mean, you know, the mayor's always said the single biggest reason why middle-class families move out of the city is because of the city school district. And I think this project, the $1.2 billion project, which, by the way, is the largest single works project, public works project in the history of Rochester, I think it'll go a long way to do that. At least it'll be, you know, one piece, a major piece of dispelling that overall perception.
Yeah, and then eventually it'll be then about understanding how reputation might have to follow that, and it could be slow. It's changing the culture of expectation. But in other words, it does sound like you could say to Fred, eventually we're going to get to the point where you can't really say the suburban schools have facilities that are better, classrooms that are better, more equipped, better art programs, better music. That can really change here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it will.
Travis, how do you feel about that?
I agree totally as well. From my perspective, working with Savin and been involved in K-12 construction for a few decades now, comparing it with, for example, school districts in Long Island and downstate, and what's going on here, we have resources of architectural firms here in upstate and western New York that are some of the best in the country. We have construction managers, some of the best in the country. And utilizing their talents and skills, these facilities are top of the line that are being built. I would invite anyone perhaps to contact us and ask perhaps for tours. A good example is School 12, the Duffy School on South Street that was completed last year. Wonderful example of technology, ingenuity with design, nice open spaces, sight lines of facilities that could be seen as what is being representative of the work being done.
Okay. Mike, how would you respond to Fred?
I think the proof is definitely when you walk onto our campuses. So I think in phase one, our building at our renovation at Charlotte it's become a dynamic instructional space, but maintain the historical look of the building structure itself. I think as we move forward, our next large high school initiative is at Monroe. When that building will completely transform that neighborhood in terms of the extracurricular spaces on the outside of the building, but also the instructional spaces on the inside of the building. If you drive on Hudson Ave and look at our new athletic fields at Franklin, or drive along Culver and look at the new fields at East, our athletic infrastructure is approaching state of the art, where we'll have five all-purpose fields when Monroe's opens in the fall of 2018, and I think that in and of itself is we're focused on all extracurricular activities, but our campuses look dynamically different than they were when I arrived here in 2012. So yeah, we're very proud of the different progress we've made, but we also know that there's more work to be done. I think the other part of it is in our business we work with our colleagues in the suburban areas, and they also have weighed in on how far we have come in a very short amount of time in terms of upgrading our particular facilities. I think one other one we didn't mention, but the restoration of the Franklin Auditorium, the theater, it was just an amazing accomplishment. So I think we've got an awful lot of resources here in the city to build upon, and I think momentum is really on our side.
Yeah, and I just want to piggyback on Fred's email to the program on this whole suburban city divide, or at least the perception that's out there. Another perception that I'd like you to weigh in on is it's not just that the stereotype is suburban schools have better amenities or better classrooms or better this or that. It's that, yes, the city schools have some, but it's, sort of to small slice. It's the sodas of the world. There's a few, but it's not all of them. I hear that from suburban parents a lot. I don't know. Alan, is that true anymore, and is that changing with this?
I think it's changing quite a bit, okay. Especially when, like I said, when you go to a school like School 12 or 28, or 58, which is one of the other schools that people normally cite as having sort of parity, if you would, with mm-hmm. a lot of suburban districts. But when I see the work that's going on at Monroe, or the school, number one school, which will be the Children's School of Rochester up at Cobbs Hill, once it's done, it really will, I don't think that any school can surpass the overall facilities that will come out of this once it's completed.
Do you think that 10 years from now, we won't have nearly as many conversations about how, well, if you're going to raise your kids in the city, there's soda, there's a few. The conversation will be much more about and sort of inequality of opportunity and quality when it comes to classrooms, facilities, amenities.
Yes. And when there are a whole lot of facets to quality education, if you would. One piece of it is the actual physical plant, the buildings themselves. And I think once that's done with this project, that piece will be taken off the table in terms of no one will be able to say, well, I like to send my child to school 16 or school number 2 or 4, but the building's just not up to what my expectations are. So I think that piece will be taken off.
Yeah,
off the table.
Yeah, Mike.
You had mentioned the neighborhood schools conversation, and that's often where we hear that dialogue in regards to a parent making a choice about a building in a different neighborhood, and oftentimes we will hear the quality of the physical structure being part of that. I think in this between the first phase of the schools we've already mentioned, and now in this phase with the additional 8 elementary schools, which will be completely renovated, and that changes that dynamic immensely. And in this phase, school 2, school number 2, Clara Barton, school number 4, are both buildings that will leave as successful physical structures, but are in an area where that modernization is really going to be very beneficial for neighborhood families to return back to their neighborhood school if they choose to do so. So I think taking that piece off the table will be very powerful for us.
We're also talking about buildings, some of them more than 100 years old. I mean, what's the challenge when it comes to the infrastructure?
Right. And that's a big piece of it is because, if you look at the average age of buildings in the district, they're approaching 100 years old. So a big piece of the overall renovation project is bringing or changing or modernizing things like the roofing system, the plumbing and heating system, the electrical pieces. The term that the district uses is they do what's called a BCS, a Buildings Condition Survey. They go through and say, look, these are the things that we need to do in terms of upgrading the plumbing, the heating, or in some cases, a lot of the classrooms are not up to SED standards, if you would, in terms of the overall size. So we have to, we engage in wherever we can to moving walls to make sure that the classrooms themselves meet the minimum standards that the SED requires for a school in 2017.
That's not always the sexiest headline,
Right, it's not. So
the big new athletic field or, new smart boards in every classroom is a little more enticing, but it's vital that this gets done, isn't it?
Right, it is.
Yeah, and Travis, any challenges for Savin in this particular regard, the age of the buildings?
Well, the State Education Department, back in 2000, they instituted the Comprehensive Building Safety Program, which required all school districts to do annual visual inspections and building condition surveys. And based on those, they provide the baseline for where there are structural or infrastructure improvements for each facility. Those serve as a basis to itemize what are the physical components that need to be addressed, especially in relation to life expectancy and health and safety. So with that in hand, that in turn combined, merged into the strategic plan, it helps us to identify with the board's direction, what are the schools that need to be prioritized as receiving these upgrades. So as the program manager, we're very fortunate. We have as our program director, Pepin Asilian, and Roland Coleman as our deputy. They represent from an engineering and educational planning perspective, talent that has done this at a very high level for a long time. And so because of that, we're able to implement this, we think, in a very effective way.
Listeners, we're talking about the Rochester Facilities Modernization Program, and Travis Miller is with Savin Engineers, and it's important to point out there have been questions publicly and privately about diversity goals and whether they're being met here, and Travis, you're part of what the message I know you want to send here is that those goals are being met, yes?
They are. This is a very important part, Evan, because the board aggressively implemented a 33% diversity goal. And that's applying to not only contracting, but also professional services. So any contract that is awarded under this program has those guidelines written in to meet these inclusion goals. We received from our independent compliance officer just this week our August statistics. And right now we are currently at 51%. Of all of the contracted money, which totally right now is $86 million to date, of that $86 million, 51% has gone to minority, women, small, and disadvantaged enterprises. This is outstanding. Because what it means is that opportunities are being given to businesses, and very often ones that perhaps have not engaged in public sector bidding work. But we are giving them the exposure to how it's done and helping them to be able to have another opportunity to grow and expand their possibilities.
Yeah, this is an important moment to point out. I mean, once in a while we hear from listeners or people in the community who will push back and say, well, I don't want to set a floor, a baseline floor, that there has to be X amount going to minority women-owned businesses, et cetera, because what if we can't find that firm? What if there's not a bid? What you're saying is there are entities that can do the work if they're included in the conversation, yes?
Yes, and that's a big part of what our department is doing. We're trying to explain the importance of getting certification. New York State, they have a program by which firms can apply, and with that certification in hand, it opens up so many doors, particularly on projects like this, to be able to be utilized. We use communication methods to get the word out in advance of bids so that the particular scopes of works that are applicable to any trade, they're aware of it. And we feel also that between the training that's being provided, the mentoring that's occurring, firms are being able to structure their operations so that they can become more efficient and more profitable. It's a big part of what we're doing.
All right. Alan, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
I was going to say, too, that the board really looks at the modernization project as more than just a means to renovate the buildings. I mean, it really is a means for economic development within the city and the overall region. Again, as you know, as the largest public works project in the history of Rochester, we really want to make sure that participants or residents, both of the city as well as the surrounding counties, have an opportunity to participate and to build capacity.
Well, a listener wants to know, and we're starting to run short on time, so if you're just joining us, we're going to have our guests run down what's coming up next once again with the Facilities Modernization Program, so you're kind of up to speed on what's being done and what the timeline is. But a listener wants to know, just curious as to what will happen to Urban Suburban's program with modernization. Alan?
Hopefully it will expand, but I'm not the... To a large extent, the urban-suburban piece is outside of our purview, but you know, hopefully, it will. And most, my understanding is, the urban-suburban program, as it stands now, has always been a one-way screen in the sense that students from the city go to schools in the suburbs, but there's very little, if any, students from the suburbs who are coming to schools in the city. So hopefully, with this will be the completion of this project will be a way to sort of change that. That dynamic.
Yeah, Mike, you want to add to that?
No, I would absolutely agree. I think that the definitely changes the conversation. We'd like to see many more students from our suburban neighbors take advantage of the resources and the opportunities that we have here in the city of Rochester. We have not just School of the Arts, but we hope to have many more programs that would mirror that across the board.
Yeah, wouldn't that be interesting? Well, in our remaining minutes, why don't I have our guests once again tell you what's coming up next here? You know, we're talking about a $1.2 billion overall outlay. It's been a project that's been going on for 10 years plus, and they're aiming at a 2021 completion date. So what's next? I'll start with you, Alan. Remind our listeners what's coming up next.
I say next, in terms of this year, the bids will be let for school 54/30 in terms of the both the contractor as well as the subcontractors coming out. And I think the key piece or the key deliverable for 2018 will be Monroe High School, more so than anything else. I mean, we're really looking, I mean, I think, as Mike said before, when that project's completed, it really will make a big difference in that neighborhood, as well as the work that we're doing right across the street from Monroe at School Without Walls.
And how are you going about this work to... Is there any displacement, any issues that you have, you know, the challenges that you're dealing with the existing school communities on this?
I can't think of. Well.
Well, I think, I was going to say, I can probably provide a little clarity. The schools that will be completed in the fall of 18, or in the sense, August of 18, Monroe, School 7, School 16, Those students are all currently in Swing Space, so they'll be very happy to transition from the Swing Space locations that they're at, which are a temporary location back to the, for them to a completely renovated a new building. We are also going to be completing the children's school. School 15 will be relocating. And then we have another wave of schools that will be leaving their school, going to Swing Space, and going into that renovation as well. So School 10 and School 2 will be located on the Marshall campus. And they'll be renovated in 18-19, as well as School number 22, which is currently at Franklin in Swing Space. We'll have that completed in the fall of 19 as well. And that's an exciting project because of the connection with the Jordan Health Center and some of the other things going on in that neighborhood. So all of these schools have their own individual stories, and they're all very exciting to take. It would take much more time to kind of go through each one of them. But certainly we're very, very, very excited about the momentum that we have and the opportunity that we have to do multiple schools in each one of these waves, so to speak.
You can follow along the Rochester Schools Modernization Program online. It's rsmpnews.net, rsmpnews.net. I'm trying to think, if you had a 10 to 15 year schools modernization program that started in like 1993, that would have happened while the internet essentially became a thing in our lives. I mean, so you start this in 2007, you know, fortunately by then, smartphones were coming out and a lot more smart technology was coming out. But Alan, is there a single thing that's kind of hit in the middle of this project where you went, oh man, like, you know, we did not account for this. You know, whereas had this been like 93, that would have been a pain to see how quickly the internet became a part of our lives and how much classrooms need and schools need to be able to deal with that. Has there been anything that's come up since 2007 that you maybe didn't account for initially, but now you've had to build in?
And this whole issue of green technology is what we're making sure that we are incorporating into both the building designs and the construction as we move forward.
Green technology?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about what that
means.
Well,
in terms of looking at how do we make sure that the buildings themselves are both energy efficient.
Okay.
Are comfortable,
energy efficiency, yeah.
And, you know, will not sort of disturb the environment. You know, for example, in most of the schools, the majority of schools that within the district, they had a big problem with asbestos. But, you know, 15, 20 years ago, asbestos was the sort of wonder material in terms of heating and everything else. But now we find that because of the environmental issues, that we have to take it out. And that's been another big expense within the district. Within the project itself.
There does seem, and this is purely anecdotal, but there really does seem to be a lot more conversation today than 10 years ago when it comes to just carbon footprint, you know, what every single building is doing with output. Mm-hmm. And so, interesting. Is any challenge for Seven and partners on that, Travis?
Well, I would agree with Alan. It's something that the board is aware of, and so we give direction to the designers. And again, this is where we tap into their experience and background. They're designing a lot of other types of structures besides schools as well. And very often, sometimes in the private sector, they're able to incorporate some cutting edge things that they can share with us and bring into what we're doing. So it's being addressed. There are sometimes budget concerns as to how much you can do, but to the extent that they are practical, viable, the board has been very open to considering them.
I want to thank our guests for taking the time to come in, and I hope you'll come back with some regularity as we go throughout the next 4 or 5 years toward completion of a $1.2 billion program, the Rochester Schools Modernization Program. And, you know, really, since this was our first at-length conversation on the subject in a while on this, we kind of just scratched the surface, and there will be other issues. We'll have a chance to continue to communicate with them. But I want to thank our guests who have been in studio with us. You just heard Travis Miller, Business Opportunities Program Manager for Savin Engineers. Travis, thanks for being here. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Evan.
Also, thanks to Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Rochester Joint Schools Construction Board. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
And the chair is Alan Williams. Nice to have you back, Alan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right. A little bit of a change of pace next hour. We'll see if you're ready for it as we close the week on Connections.